But the Baruch Hashem Moshe Vayomer Lav Ani Adonai Vayirai Al Avraham Al Yitzchak Vel Yaakov Vel Shaddai Ushmi Adonai Lo Nodati Lahem. Now this is God's word to Moshe. He does not at any point tell Moshe to pass this word on to Bnei Israel, which talks about something to do with the nature of the revelation to the Avot as opposed to Moshe. V'gam hakimoti apriti itam latet lahem et eretz Kanaan. I fulfilled my brit with them, them being the Avot, to give them the land of Canaan, which is a little bit strange because he didn't give it to them. All he did was make the brit, but he didn't give it to them yet. So the question is, what does this mean? Does this mean that I've given it to them in potential, or does it mean that I am now going to fulfill the brit with them that I promised them, and that's going to be through you? Unclear which it is. And that phrase itself might give away exactly what the problem is. Because what is lagur? And lagur is a great example of a word that in Tanakh takes on a very different meaning than it does in modern Hebrew. Or should we say in modern Hebrew it's used differently than Tanakh. In modern Hebrew, what's lagur?
To live.
To live. Right? Makom megurim is your residence.
Reside.
What is lagur in Tanakh? It's the exact opposite. It's passed through. So sojourn. Right, it's the pass through. And so a ger is the opposite of a toshav. Avram says, ger v'toshav anochi imachem. Okay, so Eretz Megoreim asher garuva emphasizes the fact that they were not permanent residents in Israel or in any location in Israel. They were traveling through, which makes it difficult to say I've already given them the land unless you mean I've given it to them as a promise but not in actuality. Okay. V'gam ani shamati, and this cuts into our section. V'gam ani shamati in nakab bnei Yisrael shemitzrayim ma'avidim otam v'yizkor et briti. Now, et briti what? So briti sounds like I've remembered my brit to give them the land, which means that you're on top there.
Yes.
Which means that now this brit that I made with them to give them the land, I now see that bnei Yisrael. And now see, this is all difficult. I now hear, I remember. What does all that mean in the context of God? It's difficult in itself. But I am now activating, as it were, my brit. And what's that brit? To give them the land. All right, fine. Lachain. Now, what does lachain mean? Critical to understand. Lachain is a vital word which means very little. Because it's transition from cause to effect. From circumstance to response. The circumstance is the following premises. We've laid out like an argument. Premise one. I appeared to the Avot. Premise two, I made them a promise. Premise three, that promise is associated with a brit. Premise four, I see that their children, who are supposed to be the ones that are the beneficiaries of that brit, right now are suffering, and I'm activating that brit. Vayizkor et briti. Okay? Lachein. So based on those four premises, what am I going to do? And more Bnei Yisrael on the Adonai. So the first thing is, you're to go tell Bnei Yisrael on the Hashem. Okay? That's the first thing. In other words, you're going to go to Bnei Yisrael and present to them the following words that begin with Ani Hashem, which means that everything I've said till now is the presentation to you, but not necessarily to them. This is all the background. Now, what is it you're supposed to tell them? V'hotzeti etchem. Now, critical to note, had he said v'hotzeti otam, then what would it mean? It would mean all you come to do is say to them, Ani Hashem. And by the way, I'm telling you, I'm going to take them out. But v'hotzeti etchem means this is not what you're supposed to tell them. V'hotzeti etchem, again, I asked you before, what do you think it means? You think it means to take you out of Mitzrayim. That's not what it means. What does it mean? V'hotzeti etchem mitachat sivlot Mitzrayim. Which means? I'm going to take you out from under the terrible oppression of Egypt. Which means, if you picture what happens, what's the before and after picture look like? The before picture looks like Egyptians whipping us. What's the after picture look like? Us doing normal work. Slaves, but not oppressed. You can be a slave without oppression. That's step one.
Is that the right use of the word behotzeti? I mean, shouldn't there have been a better word?
No, why? You are under the thumb of oppression. I'm going to take you out from that oppression. What's the second thing? So this is a stage. First stage is I'm going to take you out from under the oppression. What's the second stage? Rescue you from what? Again, you're still in Egypt. There's no geographic displacement happening at all. Now remember, this is all, what's the background of this whole thing? The background of this whole thing is a brit to give them the land of Israel, the land of Canaan. But that's not on the table now. So what is it I'm promising to do? I'm going to take you out from the oppression of Egypt. I'm going to save you from what? Me'avodatam, which means?
Servitude.
In other words, you're going to stay right where you are, but you will no longer be enslaved. Now, this may be a commentary on the first, meaning, how am I going to do these things? I'm going to do these things with an outstretched arm and with big judgments, whatever that may mean. We see how it plays out, but we don't know what it means in this context, but it means some sort of a revelation and a manifestation of God's presence in Egypt. And I'm going to redeem you. Again, there's no geographic movement here at all. And then what's going to happen next?
Taking
the nation. Which means what, in practical terms?
Taking the nation.
Which means what, in practical terms? It means reforging a brit of some sort, reestablishing the relationship, again, right there in Egypt. There's no mention of going anywhere. And then, v'idatem ki ani Adonai Elohim hamotzi etchem. And again, you would think hamotzi etchem mi'eretz Mitzrayim, that's what you want. But it's not. Hamotzi etchem mitachat sivlot Mitzrayim. So it's very clear that hamotzi etchem is not a geographic movement. It is a political reality or an economic reality. So what are the stages that are going to happen here? If you wish to look at them at four stages, and they may not be. The first stage would be no more oppression. Second stage would be no more servitude. Third stage would be some sort of gula, whatever that may mean. And fourth stage now is the affirmative reestablishment of a relationship with God. Right? Now, let's try to figure out what number three is before we go further. What's v'galti etchem? So what does gula mean? The word gula. What does it mean?
Redemption.
That's a translation. What does it mean? What does it mean to redeem? Just in English, what does the word mean?
Take it back.
Hmm?
Stand up on behalf of a person and give them, your reciprocal benefit.
Good. So I'll tell you what the Ramban says in his introduction to Sefer Shmot, which is as close a definition of Geula as you could get based on what the word Geula means in Tanakh. Geula in Tanakh. The Ramban builds on Geula where it appears most prominently. Where does Geula appear most prominently? Besides in passages in Yeshayahu?
Ruth.
What? Right. In the whole passage about Ruth, which is anchored in the key passage in Chumash about Geula, which is in Bahar, which is all about Geulat Karka. Right? Meaning, I am a member of Shevet Zvulun, and I became very poor, and I had to sell my land, so I need another member of the family to come and buy that land to keep it in Zvulun, keep it in the Beit Av, and if possible, get it back to me when I'm back on my feet. That's called Geulat Karka. And that phrase shows up over and over and over in the context of Sdei Achuza, and Sdei Mikna, and Bateri Choma, etc., about Geula, about redemption. What does redemption mean? So the Ramban says redemption means to restore something to its proper place. That's all. That's what Geula is. And think about it, in English, what redemption is. You have a bunch of cans, and then you go in and get a redemption value. You give them back to their original owner, and you get some money for it. That's Geula. Right? Another word for Geula would be pidyon. And those are words that operate as somewhat synonymous. And what's pidyon? You pay money, and you get somebody back to where they were. They used to be free, now they're free again. Pidyon shfuyim. So that's what Geula is. So Ge'alti Etchem here may mean, what was your status before? What was your status until this revolution in Egypt that turned you guys into slaves?
You belonged to Pharaoh, maybe?
Not at all. What was your status? You were the elite of the land. You were the lead of the land. So v'ga'alti etchem would mean, then mean I'm going to turn you back into the elite of the land. And then I'm going to forge a relationship with you. So now the stages are really the inverse simply of what has happened over the last few hundred years, or 200 years, whatever, however long it's been, which is we've lost our relationship, you've lost your standing, you then got enslaved, and then you got oppressed. So unoppress you, unenslave you, restore you to your class, your upper class status, and then reforge the covenant. Beautiful. In the meantime, nothing's happened. Nobody's moved anywhere. I mean, a lot has happened. Nobody's moved anywhere. This is the image that he gives Moshe. And then what? Ve'heveti etchem el ha'aretz. Now, when's that supposed to happen? At no point here is there any timeline. They'll say Tiyatchem, and 2 weeks later we tell Tiyatchem, and 6 days later we gal Tiyatchem, and 4 hours later it doesn't say that. We don't know if this is boom, 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 or it's going to happen over dozens of years. We don't know. At some point in the process, the end goal, of course, is Veveti Etchem El Aretz. Why? Because this entire process is all motivated by a brit that I made with your avot, and I can't fulfill the brit if you guys are oppressed here. So I got to unoppress you. I got to unenslave you. I got to lower class you. And then I got to reforge the brit, and then, boom, we're going to come back. So the image, by the way, of this, if you were to read it, is in Egypt, at some point, perhaps quickly, all four stages are going to happen. Suddenly there's going to be a noble class of Yaakov's descendants who are doing well and who have now reforged the brit with God, and then they're going to pick up and walk into Israel. That's it. There's no desert. By the way, there's no Har Sinai in this picture. There's none of that. There's this, and Malkatiyat Chavlam happens in Egypt, and then they go straight in. There's no image different than that. Now, what happens as a result? By the Ber Moshe Keno, B'nai Yisrael, Moshe does exactly what he's supposed to do. He tells B'nai Yisrael this entire message. B'nai Yisrael can't hear it. They can't get the message. There's too much hard work, too little breathing, meaning you can't envision something that crazy. As we, the lowest class, the enslaved, oppressed class, I mean, imagine, just a crazy imagination, coming to Jews in the middle of World War II and saying, soon you're going to be the rulers over this entire Europe. You can't even imagine it. You're too busy trying to survive. Now, I'm not trying to equate the two, and the images that we have of Mitzrayim don't at all equate to what we saw 70, 80 years ago, but just to see how unbelievable it is, people cannot contend with it. They don't believe it. And that, from there on, everything continues, but goes at a much slower pace. And Yetzias Mitzrayim seems to take a lot longer than it needed to, and it goes in fits and starts, and even finally when it happens, it doesn't happen, because Haraya, instead of going straight to Israel, we have to go to the Midbar, we have to play games and fool Paro, and get him to Yam Suf, and then after that, we suddenly have to wander around for a while, and then get to Har Sinai, and then stay at Har Sinai for a while, and we've got all sorts of things in the way that keep us for a whole generation in the desert. So I'd like to suggest that this scenario, this four-stage process, which is really a five-stage process, because you're right, BVT is not only part of it, it's the goal of it, is really something that dates back to an event that we have too much information about. I know that's something we're not accustomed to hearing. But reality is that when you read a narrative of the Torah, you always have to wonder, A, why is this narrative here at all? And B, if it's here, why am I getting the details I'm getting? Right? Why am I told that Hagar is from Mitzrayim? Who cares that she's from Mitzrayim? Shivcha Mitzrit. Why is that important? I don't find out where Keturah is from. Right? As an example. Right? I get some information. I don't get other information. I don't know why. There's a narrative that we saw last week that is strange, and there's a lot of details we're given about it that seem to be odd, seem to be superfluous. And that is the narrative that's the bottom page one, which is the narrative of Moshe's birth. Moshe's birth and salvation. And so let's read it through, take a look at what the psukim say, what the psukim mean, what we can get from there, and see if maybe it'll shed some light on what we're doing. Alright, after the first chapter, which tells the story of Bnei Yisrael growing in amazing numbers, and then of Bnei Yisrael, Paro, and his accusations, concern about Bnei Yisrael Rav Yatsumimenu, and as a result of that, the decree about the servitude and the decree about the midwives, and finally the last decree, which is to throw all the kids in the water, whether that ever gets actualized or not, but there is such a thing. Immediately after that, we find this. And one of the things that you should immediately stick out when you're looking at this parsha is the fact that there are no names. We have five major characters in the story. We don't have a single name. Some names will get soon. Some names we'll never get. We'll never get the name of the baby. We'll never get the name of the princess. Although if you want to argue that Bitya is this princess, you can argue it. It probably won't succeed, but okay. So, simple read of this is that a man from the family of Levi goes and takes a woman from the family of Levi. Bat Levi, we later find out, is actually a real daughter of Levi, which makes this woman a higher generation than he is, and it turns out she's his aunt, and that's got its own weirdness. Okay. Batar Isha Vatera Ben. Right, the woman gets pregnant, and she has a son. Vatero Tokitovu. Now, by the way, with the background of the previous Pasuk, this should immediately get us worried, because what was the decree? Throw all baby boys in the water. Now, just parenthetically, I got to ask a question. How was this, and it's something I don't understand, maybe somebody can suggest, how was this decree supposed to be enforced? How was this decree supposed to be enforced?
How are you going to
throw all the babies in the water? You're going to trust the Jewish women are going to say, oh, it's a boy, let's throw him in the water? What do we think is going to happen? After all, the midwives weren't willing to step in and kill babies when they weren't even born yet. All the ovnaim there probably is a prenatal test, and they still weren't willing to do it. So, what are we thinking is happening? What are we imagining? We're imagining, first of all, and this is probably accurate, that by this time the Ivrim are living among the Mitzrim, which if you think about it is a little strange, because normally when you have an entire caste who are slaves, they don't live in regular houses next to the people who own them. That's a little strange. I mean, that's one weird thing.
But they weren't slaves before.
But now they are.
But maybe they kept their houses.
Which is odd, because why wouldn't we seize their houses and put them into Soweto or something? You know, some slave going to camp.
They had their own stalker system.
What? How do we know that? Why would we think that they had that? And if so, that's the case. Why didn't that work with the midwives?
But maybe they didn't want them in their communities anyway, because they lived apart.
But they didn't live apart. It's clear they lived together, because otherwise, what do you have to put dam on the door in Korban Pesach? Right? They live right there. No question. They're gone. Goshen's an old story now. Right? So... It's very odd to have this decree supposed to work, but regardless, if somebody comes with a suggestion, please let me know. I don't know how it's supposed to happen. And it may indeed be that it never worked. It could be that Paro made the decree, it was on the books, in the meantime, nobody paid attention. In the meantime, Vatari Shavatei Leben. So this woman gets pregnant, has a son, and by the way, the simple read of this story, if I don't have any more information, is this is a young couple, or however old, they get married, and this is the first kid. It doesn't sound like this is a family that's already got kids and something happening, but we don't really have the data, and later on we find out that we're wrong. Vatero Tokitovu, what does she see about the kid? He's good. What does that mean? She sees the kid is good. What does it mean? What does that mean, the kid is good?
Yeah, a bad baby, a good baby.
Yeah, so, he's a bad baby. Yeah. It makes it harder to throw him in the water because he's a good baby. What does it mean, good baby? Right? Come on, a newborn baby. Right? So the reality is actually that the Pasuk tells us. If you listen very carefully, the Torah tells you way more than you thought. Vatero tokitovu batitz b'nei shloshay yirachim. That's the answer. She sees he's good and she hides him for 3 months. So what does he's good mean? He's quiet. He's a calm baby, which means you can hide him. He's not making a fuss. The neighbors aren't talking about it. Right? And the neighbors aren't complaining at 2 in the morning with the crying baby and all that kind of stuff. However, all good things come to an end. She couldn't hide him anymore. Now, what was the decree, by the way? Important to note. What was the decree? Throw him in the water. I want you to notice she does exactly that. She totally fulfills the decree. Right? I didn't say I couldn't use a basket. Right? Just a decree. I didn't say I couldn't pitch the basket. Right? So what happens? So she takes a basket of reeds. Now, where do you get reeds?
Side of the water.
Why the side of the water? If you go to the Kern River, you will not see reeds next to the water.
Well, in the Nile,
why the Nile? Well, how's the Nile different than the Kern?
Fertile.
What? Because the Nile overflows on a regular basis. As a result of it, it's not dry land on the side, but rather marshland, swamp. Right? Picture the near the mouth of the Mississippi. Right, which every couple of years we see lots of television footage of, and it's all swampy.
It's the bayou.
Right, the bayou, because there's just lots of overflow there. Okay, now, she takes reeds and fashions a basket, she then pitches it. Why did she pitch it? Because she wants it to be waterproof. You make a basket out of reeds, it's going to sink. Matasim batayel, she puts the kid into the basket. Matasim basufas fatayor. Now this is where everybody's where Spielberg did everybody a disservice with his movie, among many, many other examples. If I were to ask the average person on the street, I won't ask you, Mike, the average person on the street, what happened to the basket? Everybody will tell you, I promise they'll tell you. Right? That the basket was put on the water, and then what happened? Come on, tell me what happened.
Floated.
It didn't float. It went quick. It was class 5 rapids, and Moshe's going like this, and he's got the oars and the thing, and he's got the life vest and everything else. I know, because I saw it, and by the way, I happened to hear Ofer Chaza singing to him as he was as going. Right? The only problem is, it's not true. The thing didn't move at all. Read the text. Vatasa masufa svatayor. Where did she put the basket? In the marsh. It doesn't move. The water's stagnant there. She puts it there. It doesn't move anywhere. Right? We don't.
What did she do? Just be yards into the creek?
Well, no, something else. Evidently, she knew, and this, in a sense, foreshadows one of the last stories in Tanakh, which is the story of Megillat Esther, is foreshadows this sense of an oppressed people who feel we've got our man on the inside, our woman on the inside. Because who's going to come to this place very soon? By Paro. Now, you got to remember, what would happen if this were a secluded beach that nobody comes to? By Paro. Soon is going to show up. What would happen if this were a secluded beach that nobody comes to? Or the kid would be dead. Kid would die. What happens if this is a public beach where there's a lot of people? You have no idea what's going to happen. To put the kid there and watch him and nobody does anything doesn't make any sense. Which means she's got to know that somebody's going to be coming and it's going to be somebody who at least there's a good chance is going to behave in an unusual way and save the kid.
She's also taking the risk that Paro used to go every day.
If Paro went to the same place. Very likely, but Paro has her own place because remember, bathing then isn't in some fancy swimming suit. Right? So what happens? Here we go. Suddenly, out of nowhere, comes a sister. The sister is obviously not a twin, not a twin sister. And she's standing from the distance watching to see the Deyamaya Selo, to see what's going to happen to the kid. By the way, who's Achoto? I just wanted, like, if you're just reading this parsha, who's Achoto? Achoto Shomi. Who says? If this is a young couple, if this is a young couple who just got married, which is the sense of the text, then who's Achoto? It could be the father's sister. It could be something else also. We saw talked about this a few weeks ago. What does the word ach mean in Tanakh? Ach in Tanakh means a sibling. It means a male relative, a blood male relative, like a nephew. It also means a partner, a business partner. Right? Chiram says to Shlomo, Chiram is not even Jewish. What does he say to Shlomo? Ma he'arim ha'ela shenatata li achi. Achi, like we say in Israel today. Bro. So it could be that Achoto means there's some sort of a friend of the family who's watching. Now, we later find out that there is a sister, right? But within the context of this story alone, it could be interpreted differently. Okay. And by the way, no brother shows up in this story either. So at this point, the family is a father, a mother, a little baby, and then an Achoto, who again could be not a family member. Now Bat Paro comes down to bathe. So Bat Paro is in the water, and the girls are walking next to the water. What happens? She sees the basket in the marsh. Little shot. What does it mean? She sends a maid servant to go get the basket. What's the very famous midrash about this? Amma being a hand, and Rashi quotes it, that her hand shot out to great distance and brought it in. Miraculously, it's beautiful. And then Rashi on the spot says, but it's not pshat because then the mem should have a dagation. Alright, so it's a nice midrash. So where's that midrash coming from? So I'll tell you when we get to the end where I think that's coming from. What happens? What does she see in the basket? A kid. Now, what is the most reasonable conclusion about who this kid is? Why? Because if he was a Hebrew. Because if he was just an unwanted child, what would not be there? The basket, the pitch, right? In other words, here's a kid who on the one hand has been abandoned, as it were, on the other hand, been protected. So the only reasonable conclusion is this is an Ivri kid who the mother had to get rid of, but wants someone to pick up. And what is her reaction? She has compassion. Now somehow the mother had to know Bat Paro, or hope that Bat Paro is going to react that way, because this is not a public beach. This is Bat Paro's private bathing spot. So she knew Bat Paro was going to come, and she had a, for some reason, hope. There is Yisrael Eldad once suggested
Bat Paro was married at the time.
We have no information. Now Yisrael Eldad suggested, and Steiner wrote an article on whether or not this is the correct. This all depends on when we date Yitzhak Mitzrayim, which is a huge dispute and a huge problem, and therefore which Paro is the Paro of Yitzhak Mitzrayim, which is Paro is this, because it's not the same one. And depending who that is, who then Bat Paro is, there is a theory out there that Bat Paro is indeed Bintanat, who is a Phoenician princess, which would then make her a little bit of a lanceman with the Hebrews and feel like a common outsider thing. And that might be why, that's Eldad's suggestion, why Yocheved would have felt that she had some sort of a sympathetic person in the palace. Maybe. Could be. And it could be it was just a natural sympathy, you see, everyone? What?
Paro himself should have had the same...
No, Paro himself is an Egyptian. We know that some of the Paroni married Phoenicians, and in some cases, they already had their daughters. This Bintanat was a Phoenician-born girl who came into the...
From a different
nation.
Really Bat Paro?
Well, Bat Paro in the sense of the princess, meaning she's adopted it, right. If it is.
Is that a true historical figure you just said?
Yeah, Bintanat certainly is a historical figure. It's been documented in Egyptian documents also. But the question is that this one, and then that goes into the whole Bitya issue, and whether that's it. Bitya would be a great Jewish translation of Bintanat. It's exactly that's what it is. But, in any case, what Anat is a Phoenician goddess, so Bintan's daughter, Bintanat, so it works well.
How did that end up being a Hebrew name?
If she converted, as it says in Divrayamim, then she would Judaize her name, you know, just like somebody named Chris would change his name to Mashiach. Okay, sorry. Okay, that'd be cute. All right, so now, Batomri Yaldai Yivrimzeh. Right, so it says, this kid must be an Ivri. Batomra Chotol Bat Paro. Now, this would sound strange to a lot of people, except when you read Tanakh, you realize that throughout the Near East, the king's access to the public is something that is very common. We found it here when we studied Sefer Shmuel, and we saw the woman from Tekoa come up to the king and just say, King, save me. And what was the story? You know, my two sons got in a fight, and that whole famous, the Shami Tekoa. But she just walks up to David. By the way, it happens in Egypt. Moshe walks up to Paro in front of the Nile several times and just challenges him. So the royalty was far more accessible. There was no problem with paparazzi, and there's probably less problem with security. And it was probably the only issue of inaccessibility was to be able to get take care of business. So once in a while, the king would be available, and so for her to go up to Bat Paro is not that weird. Says, shall I go and summon a Hebrew nursemaid? Now, why would that be a reasonable thing to do? After all, Miriam did not overhear, if this is Miriam, did not overhear Bat Paro say, she must be a Ivri. Bat Paro said it to herself. So why would it be reasonable to come up and say, shall I call you a Hebrew nursemaid? Why would a Hebrew nursemaid be the most obvious choice? Well, I'll tell you, because if you go to... But Miriam is not supposed to know that this kid's an Ivri. She's just standing around, sees Bat Paro pick a kid out of the water. If you check Craigslist Egypt, that year, Hebrew nursemaids, left and right. Why?
No babies.
And lactating. Because all these women are lactating, they had to kill their babies, and so they're available as nursemaids. Right? So shall I go hire a Hebrew nursemaid? Go ahead. Who does she summon? She summons the kid's mother. Now, Bat Paro doesn't know this. Bat Paro doesn't know this. It's all basically a ruse, and the ruse is much bigger than anybody here thinks. Because what's going to happen at the end of this process, you'll see. Take this kid and nurse him for me. I'm going to pay you. I want you to see what's happened here. Paro up here has made a decree, kill all Jewish boys. In the meantime, every week, Paro signs a check made out to Yocheved to nurse her own child at home and raise him. So Paro's paying a Jewish mother to raise her own kid while he's got a decree, which is a big part of Utsu'et Zavetufar, a big part of the in-your-face that's happening throughout, which Chazal pick up, for instance, in Perek Aleph, when Paro says, Pen Yifrotz, and what does the Torah say? Ken Yifrotz. Paro said, I want to institute slaveries to keep them from multiplying, and in your face, Paro, they multiply even more. And that's a big part of what's happening here. Paro makes a decree to kill Jewish kids, and then Paro's signing a check every week to pay a Jewish woman to nurse her own kid and raise him. Right? What? Not at all. Not at all. No, it's simply in your face. You think you're going to be able to succeed. HaKadosh Baruch Hu has his ways of... And the critical thing is that this entire scene, you'll see, is foreshadowing Yetziat Mitzrayim. And that's why all these details, which I couldn't care about, Suf, Chemar, Zephet, all this, who cares? This entire thing is foreshadowing Yetziat Mitzrayim. And we'll see it. And that's where the Midrashim come in. So what happens? The kid grows up, meaning where does he grow up? Grows up at home. By the way, what's his name? No clue. No clue. He doesn't have a name. He's a kid. The kid had to have a name by now. Even if they didn't give him a name in the first 3 months, they said, why give him a name? We're going to throw him away anyways. But now she's raising him. And he's going to go to the palace. Give him a name. We don't hear the name. We'll never find out this name. That's why there's, 15 suggestions in the Midrash about his name. Tov and Tuvia and Chaver, Chever and Avisocho and Avigdor and Yikutiel. All these names, because we don't know what his name is. All right. So she now, the kid has grown up, she brings him to Bat Paro, and Bat Paro adopts him. Vahila Levain means she adopts him. Vatikashmo Moshe. And she calls him Moshe. Vatomer Kimina Mai Mishitihu. I pulled him out of the water. I got a question for you. What language Bat Paro speak? Egyptian. Egyptian and Hebrew are not related languages, not a Semitic language. So, what's happening? What? Moshe ze Ivrit o Mitzrit? Hashem. If that's an Egyptian name, right, then what's Minamayim Shetiyu? What does it mean? It's very strange. The two languages aren't related. So as an aside, what? Not in any way. They're not. They're totally different families of language. It's not a Semitic language, Egypt. So that's why we have all sorts of different attempts to explain what Moshe's name means. Right? The earliest is Philo and Josephus both. The problem is that they didn't have access to the right Egyptian. They had access to Egyptian of their day, but not ancient Egyptian. And so they say Mo means water and Us means pulled out of, so Mo, Sus. Okay, very nice. You can see it in the two passages here. The Rishonim all take different directions. The Ben Ezra says Moshe was not his name. It says it was Munyus. Of course, it's not Egyptian either. It's a Greek name. Right? And then the Chizkuni and the Barvinel says that actually Yocheved provided the name. Call him Moshe because you pulled him out of the water. Right? The Sforno says something very fascinating. He says she called him Moshe because just like I pulled you out of the water, you're going to pull others out of the water, which actually opens up a door for us. The problem with all of this is that the notion that he'd be given a name and raised in the palace of Paro with a Hebrew name is very bizarre. How'd he get the name? And by the way, if it is a Hebrew name, it's wrong. Because what does Moshe mean? One who pulls others out of the water. Not one who got pulled out of the water. His name should be Mashui, which would be really a disaster, or Nimsheh, which would be even worse, right? Nimsheh Rabbeinu, it just doesn't work. So it's kind of strange. You want to call him a name that's related to this event, but you're missing it by a critical difference between active and passive. What? But then what should it say? So then it should say Moshe ki min hamayim yashit. He'll take others out, not Mishitiyu. Right, it's difficult, but okay, we got the picture. But now we're going to end up with a very strange thing, which Chazal do suggest in the place, which is that Bat Paro is a Nevi'ah. To ascribe Nevi'ah, what?
There were other non-Jews who had Nevi'ah, and there were Shon by Nevi'ah. So what?
Good. So who's the one example that you could think of? It's Bilam, right? And so Bilam, Chazal talk about Lo Kam Bi Yisrael, Vabo Mod Kam, and it's Bilam, and that's our Hakadosh Baruch Hu's explanation. For you see, you guys could have had a Navi that was right, right? Bat Paro doesn't seem to rise to that. It's a very questionable thing. But our guest is right that the name Moshe is an Egyptian word, and Moses is closer to than Moshe. But this is where things get a little strange. I want to pull it back. When Moshe runs away from Egypt, the very last thing he wants to do is tell people his name. Because his picture is on every post office in Africa. He's a wanted man. So when he gets to Midian and he saves the girls, what do they say? They don't say Moshe Hitzan. They say Ish Mitzri. So you can imagine he's walking around telling him his name is Thebes, his name is Memphis, his name is Ech Weiss Nishtvus. And then finally, all those years later, there he is wandering, and he sees this bush, and he goes over, and suddenly there's a nevuah, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu speaks to him. And the person that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to speak to more than anybody in history by a factor of a gazillion, one of the first words he ever says in his career as a Navi. The first words he says to him, take a look in Source 4. The first words he says to him are, Moshe, Moshe. Call him Tuvia. Call him Memphis. Call him Bond. Call him Moshe. Why are you Dafka taking the Bat Paro's name? And don't you speak Hebrew, God? The rest of this in Hebrew. What's going on?
Possibly.
Possibly. But you're right that the simple read is that Moshe is an Egyptian word. Matter of fact, we even have a hieroglyph at the bottom of the page. And Meseis, in Egyptian, means child. Good, so now, but watch how it plays out. And you know that name because you know the name Ram Meseis, which means child of Ra. Ra is the sun god. Right? So it's not that unusual. But what happens? HaKadosh Baruch Hu takes the Egyptian name and turns it into a Hebrew name. Just like he did with Bavel, which is a Sumerian name. We talked about this in the past. It means gate to the gods. And God turns it into Bavel Mixa. And this happens with several other examples of names of places or people's names that are not Hebrew, that the Torah turns into a Hebrew name for purposes of making a certain point. Moses in Egyptian means son. HaKadosh Baruch Hu speaks to him and he says, Moshe, Moshe. Which means, I'm taking her name and I'm giving you the real meaning. You know what the real meaning is? You know who you are? You are one who takes people out of the water. In other words, who are you by definition? You are somebody whose life job is to do to everybody else what Bat Paro did for you. In other words, this passage right here, the first 10 psukim in Perek Bet, are the foreshadowing of the entire existence of Moshe's career. Which is why we get so many details. Now let's think about what are the four steps that HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Moshe I'm going to do? The first thing is, Vahotzeiti etchem. And you asked me, why use the word Vahotzeiti? I'll tell you why. Because what's the first thing Bat Paro does? She takes him out of the basket. What's the next thing? Vihitzalti etchem. She saves him. Vigaalti. This is a child who was born to a family that's noble. Where's he going to now come to? He's going to end up in a palace. V'lakachti, and then I'm going to take you. That happens at the Sneh. Moshe becomes a Navi. I'm going to add one more little knetch to this. When Moshe first comes to the Sneh, the first thing HaKadosh Baruch Hu says is Moshe, Moshe. What's the next thing he tells him? Take off your shoe. Why?
It's holy land.
How do most people understand what that means? Admat Kodesh. What makes this holy land in the middle of nowhere?
His presence.
Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu is speaking to you here. But we don't find that throughout Tanakh except in one other place. If you want HaKadosh Baruch Hu speaking to you, that makes it holy land.
No, but here it was a different type of speaking.
But we don't find that when HaKadosh Baruch Hu speaks to Moshe and Mitzrayim. Right? We don't say take your shoes off.
Do we know who was awake then?
What? We assume.
Yeah, but it doesn't
right?
have to be that he's speaking. It has to be because God said this is a holy place.
But why is this a holy place? So I understand if you say because later on in history Matan Torah is going to happen here, fine. But that doesn't happen at the beginning of the speech. It's strange. And the truth is that statement, is even a response to Moshe's doubts. Which means that that's not necessarily the scenario. So there is a midrashic direction, a faint midrashic direction that makes a suggestion. And oddly enough, this finds its echoes later on in one of the surahs. That HaKadosh Baruch Hu took Eretz Yisrael and brought it here. The Kuzari turns that one inside out because the Kuzari's famous claim is that Har Sinai has to be in Eretz Yisrael. Why? Because there's no way you can have Nevuah in Chutz La'aretz. And the biggest Nevuah in history was Mamad Har Sinai. So the Kuzari claims Har Sinai has to be in Eretz Yisrael. Which of course creates all sorts of problems of Moshe not coming in.
What?
Yeah, good. So the Kuzari and the Mamar Sheni have to take a look at it. It's wild. It's wild. right? And that then is based on Hayohaya, right? What's the famous question about Nevuah in Eretz Yisrael? Yechezkel. Yechezkel is Nevuah in Bavel. So that's why Sefer Yechezkel starts Hayohaya Dvar Hashem Yechezkel Ben Buzi, and the Gemara says Hayohaya Hayag Meshikvarya, meaning he had Nevuah in Bavel because he first had Nevuah in Eretz Yisrael. Now it's a continuation. Same thing with Moshe. Right, which by the way, this notion of folding up Eretz Yisrael and putting it under Moshe's feet and says Yad Mar Kodesh is based on which midrash? Remember the midrash about Yaakov? When Yaakov is sleeping in Beit El, what is HaKodesh Baruch Hu? The land that you're sleeping on, I'm going to give you. What's the famous midrash? And Rashi quotes it. HaKodesh Baruch Hu folded all of Eretz Yisrael and put it under Yaakov's head. The land you're on, meaning you're on top of the whole land. Right? Which then doubles back, and by the way, many midrashim about Mama, about Yaakov and the Sulam, are about Mamad Har Sinai. The Malachim Olim V'Yordim Bo Elu Moshe V'Aharon. The Sulam is Har Sinai. There's all this connection between these pieces, and so now you could even argue that Behevetia Tchem Al Haaretz is now an expansion of Moshe coming to the snare. Moshe coming to the snare is temporarily walking into Eretz I'm not Kodesh, but either way. You find these five stages are five stages that Moshe himself went through, the first three of them happening immediately upon his birth. V'hotzeiti, v'hitzalti, v'ga'alti. And Moshe himself is brought up to the palace to be raised there. V'lakachti etchem lilam. So it's indeed possible that the significance of this whole scene that we get at the beginning of Sefer Shemot in Perek Bet is that it foreshadows the entire structure of Yitzhak Mitzrayim, which then HaKadosh Baruch Hu spells out for Moshe just before he goes in. And he says, go tell Bnei Yisrael. And you should be able to recognize this, Moshe, because this is what you went through in your own salvation. As somebody who lived it, now you can explain to them what's going to happen. And by the way, that's why your name is Moshe, because you got pulled out of the water, you're not going to pull others out of the water.
Poetic justice.